Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Emily Thorson. She's a political science professor at Syracuse University's Maxwell School and the author of a new book on political misinformation titled The Invented State: Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. Emily, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we really appreciate you making the time. Now, first, I just want to say the American public has misperceptions about policies and government. I'm shocked.
Yeah.
But let me just start with, in your research, what did you find were the most common misperceptions that Americans have about government and policy?
Two of the big ones concern the national debt and TANF, which many of us think of still as welfare. So about well over half of Americans think that China owns the majority of U.S. debt. In reality, it's between 8 and 10%, depending on the year. And substantial portions of Americans think that TANF benefits are unlimited, that you can be on kind of welfare for a lifetime. And you know, the word temporary is actually in the title. So they're not unlimited. But the actual time limits vary by state, but nowhere are they completely unlimited. So those are kind of two big misperceptions that I found that were interestingly held by huge numbers of both Democrats and Republicans.
That's interesting. On the TANF one, were there also misperceptions about the ease and the amount of money that people get? Because I know in the program, or at least I think I know, you can tell me, there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through. And depending on the state you're in, it's not a tremendous amount of money at all.
That's a great question. I didn't ask about that specifically. I'm actually working with a grad student right now who's really interested in misperceptions about kind of the administrative burdens that come with TANF and whether kind of correcting those misperceptions can change people's attitudes. I think in general, your intuition is correct that people think these benefits are much easier to access than they actually are.
Mm-hmm. And interesting about the debt as well. And I can imagine, well, let me hold off on that question because I want to get at that a little more generally later. But were there misperceptions that you would identify as particularly dangerous to the way the political system works?
Well, one of the arguments that I make over the course of the book is that these policy misperceptions are, I would say, dangerous because they have downstream effects on attitudes. To give another example, later in the book, I talk about misperceptions around the refugee admission process. So people think it is much easier for refugees to enter the U.S. than it actually is, that in reality, there's extensive background checks that happen and you have to fill out a long application. And when we tell people this, when we tell people, well, here's how the system actually works, they become much more supportive of refugee policy in general. And I see this pattern with a lot of policy misperceptions that when you tell people how public policy actually works, they say, oh, actually, I kind of like that policy, right? And so I do think that it has this kind of cumulative negative effect on trust in government when people have these major misperceptions about how policy works, because when they think that all this policy is terrible, they have these negative misperceptions about it, then they're less likely to trust the government more broadly and trust that they are able to implement effective policy.
That's a really interesting point, because I've looked a little bit at trust in government, not through the lens that you just put forward, but I do know that it has reached, at least as far as we've been asking these questions, an all-time low. And it really has been a dramatic drop from the 60s and the 70s. So interesting to think that that might be a component of that. Well, this gets back to the thing I was going to ask you about before, but other than simple ignorance, is there a principal reason that you think most Americans have the misperceptions that they do?
Well, it really depends on the misperceptions. I think often when we think about misperceptions, we intuitively think about those that come from explicit misinformation, right? We think about somebody logging onto Facebook and seeing misinformation about vaccines, for example. And that kind of misinformation absolutely can have an impact. But the misperceptions that I talk about in this book are largely created through different processes, through kind of cognitive biases. For example, to take the national debt example, one of the reasons I show in the book that people hold this misperception is that they think of the national debt as similar to household debt. And when you owe money, You owe money to an external creditor. You owe it to the bank or to the credit card company, right? And so people think, all right, well, if our country owes money, we must owe it to someone outside the country, like China. In reality, this is not the case. We owe most of our money to internal creditors, so like the Federal Reserve or State Reserve banks. But that is really not intuitive to people who are thinking of this kind of household debt metaphor when they're thinking of the debt. And so cognitive biases like this can account for, I think, a lot of the misperceptions that people hold. They don't have necessarily good access to the right information because, and we can talk about this later, but the media don't do a very good job of covering kind of existing policy. And so instead, they kind of try to fill the blanks in themselves. And we know from a lot of research in psychology that when people engage in this kind of inferential reasoning, they often make mistakes, not out of malice or out of partisanship, but because it's policies are really complicated and it's hard to reason logically about them.
Interesting, interesting. Because what popped in my mind when you were using the example of TANF and maybe even the debt as well is you will hear politicians say those kinds of things in debates and elsewhere. You know, we have to worry about China holding this debt, or you know, you have the, I mean, you know, I go back to Ronald Reagan on this, but the idea of you know, the welfare queen, you know, I think was one of his images that he used in 1980. So how would you parse that out? You know, the cognitive biases versus somebody telling us that this is the case.
I certainly think that elite rhetoric is a part of it, right? That kind of most of these misperceptions are made up of kind of a soup of cognitive bias, of elite rhetoric, of sort of intuition, right? So there's no, maybe there's no one cause of it. But I will say that, you know, when I was looking at these misperceptions, one of the things I did was search through the PolitiFact archives, the factcheck.org archives, and there aren't a lot of politicians who are saying China owns most of our debt, right? Like
Interesting,
they might
interesting.
be saying, we're afraid of China, or we don't like China, or China owns too much debt, right? But they are not just straight up spreading this misperception. So while it is true that people kind of might make inferences based on that, this is not misinformation that is kind of out there in the world per se.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Syracuse University professor Emily Thorson, and we're discussing her new book. It's titled The Invented State: Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. So you were talking earlier about the complexity of the actual policies and how that, in combination with the cognitive processes that we go through as human beings, resulting in some of these misperceptions. Is it true then that the ones that are going to be hardest to fix are going to be ones where the policy is the most complex, or is there a different dynamic in terms of which ones are the most stubborn?
Not necessarily. One of the really positive parts of this book is that when I correct these policy misperceptions, people remember them. So in the book, I show the results of a study where I ask people about 15 different policy misperceptions, and then I give them the right answer. I say, okay, well, here's how much of the national debt China actually owns. Here's how TANF actually works, right? And
Hmm.
then a full month later, I go back to them again and I say, all right, now answer these questions again. And on almost all of them, they get it right. The correction works, right? So people retain this information. And one of the arguments that I make is that, contrary to sort of the belief that people just don't care about policy, I think people do care about policy. I think people really do want to understand how Social Security works, how TANF works, right? The media tend to really hyper focus on this kind of partisan competition. But I do think that there's a real thirst for kind of descriptive information about the public policies that affect people's lives. And I take the fact that people recall these corrections long after they've been given as real evidence that people are interested in this topic and they want to be right. They want to be accurate.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I just put that through the lens of my own experience. And there's always a satisfaction when you sort of figure out a puzzle or you understand something you didn't understand before. You're likely to hang on to that for a lot of different reasons. Interesting. So, were you able to tease out whether there were any patterns in the population regarding who is more likely to seriously misperceive policy?
Well, so this is where we see really interesting differences between policy misperceptions and the type of hyper-politicized misperceptions that often get a lot of focus from media and from academia, right? So I think most people, when they think about political misperceptions, think about things like vaccine misinformation and misperceptions. They maybe think of things like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, right? So these kinds of pieces of misinformation that tend to have a really partisan tint to them, right? That they're held overwhelmingly either by Democrats or Republicans. That was not the case with a lot of these. They tended to be held by almost equally by both parties. They tended to be held more by people who were less educated, which again is not the pattern we see with the hyper-politicized misinformation and misperceptions. Those it is often the more educated who hold or are more likely to hold those, partially because education is tied up with partisanship. The more educated are more partisan. But here it is the case that people who are less educated are more likely to hold these misperceptions, but they're also very correctable.
That's okay. That's really fascinating. So let me ask you about these more educated people who are more likely to get things wrong in certain way, when they're the source of hyperpartisan. Is it also because then they're paying more attention and they're more likely to hear the misinformation and take it in from,
Absolutely. So more educated people are more highly partisan, and they're more likely to have kind of highly partisan news diets and more likely to seek out political news in general, right? And so there are a lot of people in the US who just don't pay that much attention to politics, right? I think there's a narrative that we are all kind of hyper partisan and in our little echo chambers. And that is absolutely true for a subset of the population. But for most people, they go through most of their days without paying much attention to politics at all or caring, right? They don't care enough to only consume Republican or only consume Democratic news. They would prefer to just watch reality TV or read maybe the local news, right? And again, it's not out of stupidity or ignorance. It's often largely because they are sort of alienated by the hyper-partisan rhetoric that is in a lot of mainstream news these days.
So this may be outside of your lens of attention, but I was wondering if you had any sense of how we as Americans fare in these regards when compared to people in other countries, I guess, particularly Europe, let's say. I mean, do the Europeans know about how their policies work better than the Americans know about theirs?
This is a great question and something that I'd really be interested in looking at. So, one thing that we haven't really talked about that's an important piece of this puzzle is that one of the reasons that Americans kind of have to fill in the blanks themselves is because the media do a terrible job of covering existing policy, right? The media are just really laser focused on what's new. And in some ways, that's good, right? We depend on the news to tell us what is new. But that means that when you were thinking about policies that have been around for a long time, whether that's Social Security or TANF or the refugee admission process, then there's just very little coverage about it. One striking statistic when I did a content analysis of news coverage of Medicare. So this is news articles that had the word Medicare in the title, right? So they were about the policy of Medicare. Less than half of them contained any information about what Medicare is, like nothing in there about what the policy of Medicare actually is or does, right? And so if you are one of those people who doesn't consume a ton of news and you kind of glance at a news article about Medicare and you're like, I don't even know what this is, it doesn't say it anywhere in the article what this program is, that's a really frustrating experience for you. And so I think one way of kind of helping to remedy this situation is to encourage news organizations to put in more just basic descriptive information about what policies are.
Yeah, I mean, you could do that in a couple paragraphs
Exactly.
and bring people up to speed. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Emily Thorson. The Syracuse University political science professor has recently published a new book titled The Invented State: Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. And we've been discussing that book and also political misinformation and disinformation more generally. So I just mentioned political information and misinformation and disinformation. There's a heightened concern in recent years, I think, because of social media and the internet more generally, not only about misinformation, but also disinformation. So, really quickly, to take a page from what you are encouraging the media to do, tell us in a couple sentences the difference between misinformation and disinformation.
I'm going to say I'm not sure it's a really useful distinction
Oh, okay.
that kind of I would argue that what we need to focus on when we're thinking about any kind of false information that's out there is not necessarily the intent of the person behind it, but rather the effect that it's having on the audience, right? That from my perspective, we want to figure out how do we intervene to minimize the harm of false information, regardless of whether that information was spread deliberately or accidentally.
That's interesting. And I'm inferring from what you said that my sense of the difference is correct, that the disinformation is more deliberate. So there is a concern about that right now. I see the point you're making. I'm wondering then, do you see threats from Russia and China regarding, what people are reading online and that kind of thing? Are those overblown, do you think?
It really depends on the platform. The evidence from Facebook and Twitter, at least, is that those have had really minimal impact, that the reach is very small, and that when they do reach people, it tends to be people who sort of already hold whatever opinions they're espousing. So far, not really. Again, that could change with TikTok. I mean, this is fundamentally an empirical question that requires more research, and one of the things that we really need as researchers is access to some of these data, whether that's TikTok or Facebook or X, right? The more we have access to these data, the more we can answer these questions about the effects of these influence campaigns.
Interesting. I just heard a story the other day on NPR, and it was about this where the Russians had been putting out, and I don't know what venues they were, mediums they were putting it out through, but disinformation about the California wildfires in Los Angeles and the notion was that you had these Ukrainian generals, I think, that owned multi-million dollar homes, and those were some of the ones being burned up in California as to try to get Americans to be less supportive of Ukraine in the Ukrainian war. So that's interesting. So,
I mean, it's certainly out there. I am not arguing that it's not there. I think that though its reach tends to be much smaller than people imagine, right? That and even if one post, it's very hard for one post on Facebook to make a substantial difference to people's attitudes on most topics, right? So I think you would really need a much more intense campaign with a lot more exposure, right? They've done sort of randomized controlled experiments with Facebook advertisements, for example, that even after hundreds of impressions, people still don't see any attitudinal movement. And I think those of us who have used Facebook can understand why. When you're scrolling through one tiny post, you spend a fraction of a second on, right? So for the scope, for that to have an effect, that would be pretty extraordinary for something that you have a fraction of a second on to have a big effect on your attitudes.
Well, obviously, the kind of things that we're talking about in a lot of ways aren't new. I mean, I can think of the election of 1800, where the misinformation that was being put out was that Thomas Jefferson was dead. So therefore, he couldn't be president. He wasn't alive. John Adams was said to be mute. So this stuff is not new. Is it because of the internet that we are more worried about this now? Is that the reason why this is getting our hands wringing so much?
I mean, I think one of the reasons is that people sense that our system is kind of broken, right? And we could, I think it's a whole different radio show to talk about why our system is broken, but there's a lot of reasons. And people want a scapegoat, right? People want to say, oh, it's because of this, right? And misinformation is a really easy scapegoat. We could say, if it wasn't for misinformation, then things would be the way that I wanted them to, right? And this is whether that you're a Democrat or a Republican. And the kind of unfortunate and messy answer is that things are broken for a lot of complicated reasons that can't be easily solved with a tweak to Facebook's algorithm.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Emily Thorson. Her new book is titled The Invented State: Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. Well, I wanted to pick up exactly on that point that you were making there. And I think, and feel free to take issue with this if you think I'm getting this wrong or I'm about to say. But I do think it's fair to say that this idea of and the identification of misunderstandings and misperceptions on the part of the public has been politically weaponized in recent years. And one of the assertions that I have heard multiple times, and often in the academy, is that if people were just better informed, or if they were just smarter about government, they would have chosen Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. They would have chosen Kamala Harris over Donald Trump. I'm just wondering if that conversation itself, you think, makes it harder to have the kind of conversations that you're inviting us to have here about really kind of keeping our eye on the ball and understanding what's going on and seeing where misinformation is a concern and where we might be overblowing the concern.
Yeah, again, I think that scapegoating false information is not a really helpful way forward, whether on the left or the right, right? I mean, you see that kind of rhetoric on the right as well. If Democrats just understood, about how vaccines really operated, then we wouldn't be in this situation, right? I mean, this is a lot of what RFK is talking about right now with kind of health misinformation. If people just understood the real reasons for our health crises, then, and I do, I completely agree that that approach is not particularly helpful in moving forward, again, because it scapegoats misinformation in a way that isn't really justified by the evidence.
So how do you break through that? Because if you call that out, you're going to fall into the trap of being identified on either side as kind of, oh, you're just trying to push the other side's argument. And I just don't know. I just don't know how you get out of this.
I mean, I think that the answer is to try to identify the real problems that are out there that are not necessarily misinformation, right? And the problem is that the issue is that those problems are a lot less kind of sexy than misinformation, right? If we talk about kind of our maybe broken electoral system, it's a lot less fun to talk about why primaries lead to extreme candidates than it is to just blame everything on misinformation. Or a lot of the time, the problem is kind of elites spreading kind of false information, or and honestly, misinformation from elites is a lot bigger problem than misinformation on Facebook, right? But it's also not something that can be fixed with some more content moderators or a tweak to the algorithm. So it's a little bit more frustrating to talk about.
Yeah, on that point, I guess you brought up before the importance of the media giving consumers context. You know, like if they're going to have a story about Medicare, take a couple paragraphs and just explain to people how Medicare works and what it is. Do you see a role for either grade school education, maybe higher education, but that's only going to reach some people, or other kinds of things that might be outside of the media that would help in this case?
Absolutely. I think there's a real case for civics curriculums to be integrating more policy information. So, when you look at sort of civics textbooks that are used in high schools, they're really focused on how the government works, which is important, right? How does Congress work? What are the duties of the president, et cetera? But there's a whole nother category of information, which is how does Social Security work? How does Medicare work? And, you know, I understand maybe some reluctance to put that in because that can't change in a way that kind of the government setup can't. But I do think it's really useful and practical information for people to have. And the more that people have this basic information about how policies work, the more they're inoculated against future misinformation, right? The more that they'll be able to call out a politician who says, well, you know, your Social Security benefits are at risk because a lot of people are cheating the system. And they say, well, no, I know that's not true because I know how Social Security works. And I know that, you know, the safeguards that are in place, right? So yeah, I completely agree that giving people more information, not just about how government works, but how policy works early on, could be a really important inoculation strategy.
We've got two or three minutes left, and I want to get into another topic. And I know that you have personal experience in this to some degree, but Facebook just walked back some of its prior efforts to fact check and regulate the information on its site. And the concern that it seems to be responding to is that it was in effect picking political sides and what it allowed and didn't allow. And there's speculation that there's concern about, you know, not alienating the president elect too much. I understand that you were part of some of the groups that Facebook was consulting in figuring out what those protocols should be. Or you can correct me on that. But what do you make of Facebook's decision here?
mean, ultimately, Facebook is a company that's always going to do what's best for its bottom line, and expecting anything else from them is kind of silly. I think I would, I mean, it's not my job to tell Meta what to do. I don't think this is a good decision for its bottom line. You know, we've seen once X stopped really moderating content, then there's a huge exodus from the platform. The platform is making less money than it used to. And ultimately, I think the question for Facebook is letting anybody say whatever they want on Facebook good for its audience and growth or bad for its audience and growth? They are making the decision that it's good for their audience and growth, I think partially because they're worried about pushback from the coming administration. I'm not so sure that's true. I think that ultimately people don't really like seeing a lot of hate speech on the platforms that they're on. Again, most people don't like politics, right? Most people, when they go on to these platforms, they want to see pictures of cute dogs and their friends' kids. And when that's interspersed with neo-Nazi content, they don't want to be on that platform anymore.
So just a minute left, and I'm getting the sense then that you probably come down more on, given that your construction of Facebook was, hey, it's a company, let's remember that, of less rather than more public sector interference in these kinds of things. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I do not think that the government should be regulating Facebook.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. That was Emily Thorson from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. And again, her new book is titled The Invented State: Policy Misperceptions in the American Public, obviously on a centrally important topic in our political times these days. And depending on your views, her book might make you feel better. Maybe it'll make you feel worse about the current state of democracy. Emily, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really learned a lot in this conversation.
Great.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher. The program is edited by Mark Livonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.